Pediatrics is recommending that pediatricians discuss emergency contraception with their adolescent patients and that the morning after pill be made more readily available to teenagers under the age of 17. While the rate of teenage pregnancy has been dropping, it's estimated that about 80% of adolescent pregnancies are unintended. Today on Radio Times, we want to discuss adolescent sexual health, contraception use among teenagers, sex education, risky behavior, and violence. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios, and let me introduce them to you. Courtney Schreiber is an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology and the program director for the Fellowship in Family Planning at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And Courtney Schreiber, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Ann Teitelman. She's Associate Professor of Nursing and the Patricia Blesnack Silverstein and Howard A. Silverstein Chair in Global Women's Health at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. And Ann Teitelman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be here too.
Let me begin with some of the good news, and let me begin with you, Courtney Schreiber, first, if I could. The good news is that there has been a drop in teenage pregnancies, and I think that's something that we should all be very, very happy about. What's the explanation?
Yeah, I think it is wonderful news, and most of it actually has to do with increased use of contraception and a larger variety of contraceptive methods that are now available to women of all ages. So some of the decrease in the teen pregnancy rate has to do with decreased sexual initiation or postponing that to later ages, but the majority does have to do with increased contraceptive utilization.
And how dramatic is this drop?
It's been sort of gradual over decades. Actually, part of the reason for it is the comparison tends to be the 1970s and 80s, where we had a tremendous increase in unplanned pregnancy rates or pregnancy rates in general among teens. So while we see a decrease since those decades, it's actually overall, when we look at how teens behave, pretty consistent for most of human history.
How do you see these results or this phenomenon, Ann Teitelman?
Well, I think it is encouraging, but there's still that percentage who are having teen pregnancies. And we need to just marshal all our efforts forward to try to prevent those from happening, because 80% of teen pregnancies are unintended pregnancies. So the vast majority of teens who do get pregnant don't want to be pregnant. So we need to give them as many choices and opportunities to prevent pregnancies as we can. And the emergency contraception, which is also called the morning after pill, is one of the best methods. A lot of teens don't think about having sex ahead of time. So they're not planning on having sex. And sometimes, I don't know how many times, I'm also a family nurse practitioner and I work in a Title X family planning clinic, and I can't tell you how many times they tell me, you know, it just happened. Mm-hmm. And so I think having an option where they can reconcile what they really want the next day with what happened in terms of using emergency contraception is a really good option for teenagers.
And to you, Courtney Schreiber, how does it work? How does emergency contraception work?
So emergency contraception is a concentrated dose, essentially, of regular birth control pills. And in fact, the most highly utilized method of emergency contraception in the U.S. is Plan B or Plan B One Step, which is most of what this American Academy of Pediatrics document was addressing. And that actually is a concentrated dose of the safest hormonal contraceptive method, a progestin-only contraceptive method. And for the most part, it works just the way all other hormonal birth control works, by inhibiting ovulation or delaying ovulation.
And how soon after having sex should a person take emergency contraception?
And that is
what's the time frame?
That's the critical piece here, Marty, because it needs to be used as soon as possible after unprotected intercourse, and its efficacy dwindles with time. So we recommend using it within 5 days of unprotected sex, but as soon as possible, which is why this policy statement by the AAP, and by the way, many other medical organizations have similar policies, is so critical, because it gets the message out to providers of care, to teens, that we need to be enabling them to use this mm-hmm. method of contraception in a timely fashion by supplying it in advance, by providing advance prescription. That was the critical mm-hmm. piece of this policy statement, especially in the setting of it not being available over the counter for younger teens, which is our most vulnerable population.
Well, let me just pick up on that because this is critical. I want to make sure our listeners understand it. The idea that a pediatrician would give a young person a prescription for emergency contraception for that instance when they have unprotected sex.
Exactly. The data show very clearly that use of emergency contraception, or EC, is enhanced and improved if it's applied in advance, actual giving the medication in advance or giving that advance prescription.
Because if we're talking about 5 days, let's say you have unprotected sex, how long does it take to get back to your doctor to get a prescription? Is that the thinking?
Certainly. If you have intercourse on a Friday night, how are you going to get a hold of your doctor over the weekend? And then many pharmacies may not even carry the emergency contraception. So all of these present barriers to access. And lifting those barriers is going to be the key to use and the key to reducing unplanned pregnancy.
You agree with that, Anne?
I do. And the other thing that we know is that these teens who do get emergency contraception, it does not increase their sexual activity. It doesn't.
We know that.
So parents can feel comfortable in supporting their teens in getting these prescriptions and know that it is not associated with an increase of sexual activity. So it's not promoting their sexual activity. And I think parents having conversations with their teens about these issues is a very important thing.
Can I just pick up on that?
Sure.
I mean, if a pediatrician then is giving, let's say this is approved, is giving a 16-year-old a prescription for emergency contraception, is the parent involved? Is the parent told? Or is this a doctor-patient conversation and relationship?
There are certain health conditions, situations that are optional to involve parents, and sexual health, birth control, sexually transmitted infection, and also mental health issues and substance abuse issues there's a federal law that says that teens do not need parental consent to obtain these services from a provider, be it a pediatrician, a nurse practitioner, a family physician. So any provider can provide these services without parental consent.
But what I also hear you saying is that it's also important for parents to have this kind of conversation with their children.
Right. I think if parents can have those conversations, if there's an environment where it's supportive and parents can, I would encourage parents to do that, yeah.
One of the criticisms that I read about the morning after pill or emergency contraception is that it doesn't prevent sexually transmitted diseases. Is that correct?
That's true. The only available method for preventing STIs that we have now are condoms. And condoms are very important for that exact reason. However, they're not great for prevention of pregnancy. So we really do encourage dual method use. At this stage in the game, in order for young people to have healthy sexual encounters, the best idea is to use highly effective contraception. So that means long-acting reversible methods, actually, which emergency contraception is not one of those. That's a backup method for when your primary method fails, in addition to using condoms to protect oneself from sexually transmitted infections, dual method use.
And are you talking about an IUD, things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really the key to success with decreasing the unplanned pregnancy rates. When you mentioned at the beginning of the show that we've seen this decrease over time, it is clearly due to the use of increased use of contraception. And more we're moving as a society towards encouraging young people to use those most highly effective methods, IUDs and implants, for example. And recent studies are showing us that those methods are so much more effective that if we look at the data long term, women who use birth control pills and short-acting reversible methods of contraception are 22 times more likely to have an unintended pregnancy than women who are using IUDs and implants. And that's all comers. For teenagers, actually, the gap is even larger. So teenagers do need to be targeted because for them it can be harder to remember taking a birth control pill, to access contraception. Access is a real issue for teens. So if they have that device on board, they don't have to worry about becoming pregnant.
Let me pick up on something you said about condoms and put this to you, Ann Teitelman. Is it that young people, and we're focusing largely on adolescents here, don't know how to use a condom, or the condoms break, or people don't like condoms? That certainly is one method, but if there are problems, what are the problems?
Well, all of those can be problems. And in addition, what I'm finding in some of my research is that there's a fair bit of coercion, resistance on the part of partners, and even to the point of a partner having a condom on and then removing it surreptitiously during sex what one could construe as a manipulative or coercive type act if the young woman is engaging in sex thinking she's protected and she ends up not being protected.
Because it's surreptitiously taken off.
Yeah, so we call that unwanted, unprotected sex.
Wow.
And there's a whole variety of types of ways in which partner dynamics and partner abuse influence safer sex practices, from manipulative things like that, saying things to the young girl like, you're my girlfriend, you don't need to use a condom, I'm going to be with you forever, or getting angry at her if she doesn't use a condom, or say he's going to leave if she doesn't use. I mean, so these are some of the manipulative types where emotional issues are at play there.
And how common do you think that is?
I think it's way more common than we think it is. We hear it pretty commonly from girls. I would say what we know, for instance, among girls who have been diagnosed with a sexually transmitted infection or HIV, 50% report a history of physical or partner or sexual violence.
50%?
Yeah, one out of two girls who are diagnosed with a sexually transmitted infection or HIV have a history of either intimate partner violence or sexual partner violence.
So they've been coerced in one way or another.
Well, we don't know if the particular act was coerced,
right. But
we do know that there was coercion in their past, and we do know that they're at extraordinarily high risk for sexually transmitted infection.
About 45 seconds before our first break. Go ahead, Courtney
Schreiber. Just to add to that, among school-age girls, 1 in 10 will report a history of some sort of sexual or physical violence. So even in a non-high-risk group, just school-age girls, sexual violence and physical violence are very common, which is another reason why we have to help these young ladies preemptively protect themselves by making them have availability of emergency contraception if they're not using long-acting reversible methods.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Also want to open the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're discussing some new recommendations about contraception, emergency contraception, and we're talking about sexual health for young people. Our guests are Ann Teitelman. She's a associate professor of nurse at the Pennsylvania School of Nursing, University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. Courtney Schreiber, an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Pennsylvania. Again, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2013 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. Introducing the Lincoln Motor Company. More at Lincoln.com.
Let's talk numbers. Over the past 3 years, WHYY has seen a 48% decline in government funding. That's unrestricted funds we could use to pay NPR and PBS for the programs you love and produce original programs like Radio Times. Over 50% of our yearly budget comes from listeners like you. Explore the ways you can support WHYY by visiting whyy.org/support.
It's always a good feeling to give to those in need during the holidays, but it's even better when you know that your charitable donation is getting into the right hands. We'll speak with Ken Berger, the president of Charity Navigator, to find out how to tell which charities have been naughty and which ones have been nice. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Morris Arboretum supports WHYY. Its Holiday Garden Railway open daily, now through December 31st. A miniature world with thousands of lights surrounded by an outdoor quarter-mile track with model trains. Closed December 24th and 25th. MorrisArboretum.org.
This is Radio Times. Here on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Ann Teitelman and Courtney Schreiber about adolescent sexual health, contraceptive use among teenagers, the recommendation of that pediatricians discuss emergency contraception with their adolescent patients, talking about sex education, risky behavior, and violence. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Going back to the Academy's recommendation, that it's important for pediatricians to discuss a lot of these issues we have been talking about. And perhaps, Ann Teitelman, I can start with you. You work directly with a lot of young people. And I think for a lot of parents, a lot of adults, they don't know how to talk to young people about sex and sexuality. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is some of your advice?
Well, I think it's somehow surprising to many parents that teens really want to know what their parents think about issues. And yet teens sort of want a little bit of a buffer between their own personal life and their parents. So a good way for parents to talk to their teens about these issues, to let them know their views, is to talk about issues they see on the news or they read in books or they something happened to somebody they know, and then the parent is able to offer their perspective on it. And it's indirect, but it's a way for teens to know what the parent is thinking. And teens, I've done in-depth qualitative research with teens about how they learned about sex. And for the most part, what their parents say really matters to them. Whether they would agree with it or not, it is the basis for mm-hmm. their decisions. And I ask them about all different types of sources of information. And the parent is the one that they base things most on in terms of making their decision. So it really is important, and it's both mother and father to the extent that both are in the household. And it's not just biological parent, it's whoever is parenting that adolescent.
Courtney Schreiber, and it's interesting to live in a world where there's just so much information about everything, and to think that a young person and a teenager might not know about how they get pregnant or might not know some of the things that seem like common knowledge to us adults.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that we need to actively address because, as Anne says, many teens are pointing to their parents as a major source of information, but other sources include the media and their peers. And we know how the media often displays sexual activity and sexuality without a sense of responsibility, often without commitment, certainly not taking a break from that moment of passion to discuss condom use and commitment, the two C's. So in order to sort of address that issue, I think sometimes it's useful to think about this is where they're getting that information. How can we use that as an active tool for education? For example, getting back to Anne's comment, that if we take how sexuality is portrayed in the media and deconstruct that with young people mm-hmm. so that they can say, you know what, if I were in that situation, here's a way that I might modify that in order to make that a healthier encounter. And these are some of the ways that this could be improved in order to take into the entire life context into a young person's life.
Do you think, Anne, that schools have the kind of sex education that teenagers want to have or need to have? You're shaking your head. No.
In fact, we ran an intervention last year, which was a partner abuse and HIV prevention intervention, and it was a 10-hour curriculum over 3 weeks. And we talked to the teens afterwards about what how this differed from what they were learning in school. And what they said was, in school, they give us information sometimes. Some did and some didn't. Some are not getting the information. But for those who are getting the information, it's getting very dry information about sexually transmitted infections and HIV and a little bit on pregnancy. And they'd say they don't help us figure out how to use this information, how to make decisions, how to negotiate in a real situation, what our values are, what our beliefs are about these things. And so having time for discussion and values clarification mm-hmm. and practicing skills is really important piece of sexual health education, and they're not getting that in the schools.
And practicing skills, meaning literally just doing role playing to try to understand these interactions, and if I'm asked to do something I maybe don't want to do, how do I respond?
That's right. And we give them skills on how to negotiate in those types of situations, and we also give them condom skills. So we use models and real condoms, and they practice. Mm-hmm.
And that's important, right? I mean, because I was surprised to read that people don't know how to put on a condom.
It's not obvious. It's a skill. So just telling someone or showing someone a picture isn't enough. It's a skill. It's, you know, it would be like trying to send someone out to ride a bicycle. They'd never ridden a bicycle, and they're expected to ride a marathon. It takes time and practice. It's a skill-based activity. Yeah.
I was reading, Courtney, that the average age, I guess, of sexual intercourse is 17. Mm-hmm. Is that
and
about
that's
right?
That's really remained stable over decades. Mm-hmm. So it's probably not going to change dramatically. The average age of initiation of sexual intercourse is 17 in the U.S. And I think it's important to realize that rates of sexual activity as well as age of sexual initiation in the United States is similar to that of other industrialized countries. So what we do behavior-wise in terms of sexuality in the U.S., what teens do, is the same as what's going on in France and Sweden and England and other industrialized countries. But the big difference is that we have a much higher teen pregnancy rate as a result of that sexual activity. And the missing link there is contraceptive use.
And the idea of being educated about it, having access to it, and then, I guess, using it.
It's true. Most of those other countries may incorporate more comprehensive sexuality education in their schools. For example, we know that abstinence-only education does not work well to prevent pregnancy, to prevent STIs, but comprehensive sexuality education. And that's a type of sexuality education that starts when people are young, starts before they're even thinking of themselves fully as sexual mm-hmm. beings, with these topics that Anne speaks of, ideas of relationships, how to negotiate difficult situations, how to navigate new situations within relationships, so that those tools are built at a developmentally appropriate rate that suits the developmental stage of the child throughout the curriculum.
And those countries where the sexual activity is the same as the U.S., but the pregnancy rate is lower, is that what they do?
They often tend to utilize better sexuality education in the schools and have more openness in the homes as well.
Interesting. I'm also curious about the adolescent brain as mm-hmm. we understand it and how that, I guess, figures into our conversation.
Right.
Go ahead.
We're also beginning a study to try to understand that a little better. But what we do know about the brain of adolescents starting in, say, mid-adolescence going through the mid-20s is that there's a ramping up of impulsivity in the brain, the structures of the brain that are the impulsivity structures. And then the cognitive control mechanisms, which is the balancing, to balance that, are just chugging along, slowly developing, but not anywhere near at the rate that this impulsivity is. The impulsivity comes up, and then it starts to come down. And around the mid-20s is when these things come together in a good balance. So what we're seeing is physiologically teens' brains are not fully developed, and even into the mid-20s, so that trying to understand that and giving them all the tools, the best tools we have to help them make the best decisions. I think there's evidence to suggest that part of it is just also inexperience. So the more we can talk with them ahead of time, problem solve, so they can think about these ahead of time and they're not making in-the-moment decisions for the very first time, is helpful.
Let me reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers in. That's Anne Teitelman, Associate Professor of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, also with his Courtney Schreiber, Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. We are talking about teenage sexuality and sex education, the use and perhaps misuse of contraception, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think about what we're talking about? Let me see what Katie from Holland, PA has to say. And Katie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to make a comment and I have a question. When I was a young lady, I became pregnant and was terrified to tell anyone, especially my parents, and let it go so long that I ended up having a partial birth abortion when it was still legal. It was just horribly traumatic, so I made a decision to start talking to my children before I knew they were going to have sex about contraception, and gave my son condoms when he was 15, told him, don't trust a girl when she says she's on birth control, take responsibility for your own actions. And the same with my daughter, got her on birth control as she was becoming sexually active and discussed, you know, the use of condoms as well. So my thing is, are the parents getting educated about how to talk to their children, you know, and at what age is a good time to start? For me, it started very young, so that that didn't become an awkward conversation where the kids would tune out. And the second part is, with this, if the schools do give out contraception or the morning after pill and so on, is there a cost involved, and do parents, are parents informed? Thank you.
Katie, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me take the first point and put it to you and Tuttleman, and she's talking about what seems like an appropriate time for a parent to start talking with their children.
Well, I think as Corey mentioned earlier, we want parents to start talking very young, and it could be as young as using calling body parts what they really are. So that is that starts as soon as children learn language and not using euphemisms for body parts, and normalizing the body, all the parts of the body, normalizing healthy relationships. Healthy relationships also are a part of our sexuality education, because all the decisions we make about sexuality, or most of them, are in the context of a relationship. So modeling healthy relationships, talking about what that is, talking about what unhealthy relationships are early on, and building on that to making good decisions with another person, so forth and so on. And then as a child gets into the teen years, being a little bit more detailed and explicit, yeah.
Do you think, Courtney Schreiber, that parents talk to each other about their sexuality?
Oh, well, I'm sure that's highly variable. But I can second what Anne says, that talking about sort of reproduction and reproductive biology, in a sense, from a much more dry perspective in the early years, and then bringing in the sexuality part as it becomes more appropriate later, makes that transition a little bit easier. As Anne says, if somebody already knows that their boy parts are different from girl parts, somewhere along the line they'll start to wonder why, and those questions become much more easy to answer.
Katie also wanted to know, we should say the American Academy of Pediatrics was making recommendations, but she was wondering, you know, whether schools would get involved in something like this. Do you see that, Courtney?
Well, there are schools in Europe where emergency contraception is dispensed in the schools. I don't see that coming up in the United States as quickly as it might, mostly because right now for young teens, emergency contraception is available only by prescription. Right. So it's not even easy to access in a pharmacy when a prescription is required. And for older teens, and in fact for all people, men and women alike, who might want to access emergency contraception, it's behind the counter and requires ID to obtain. So we have a lot of barriers to access even as we stand right now, and I don't imagine that we're going to be moving this to the schools very quickly.
But do you think emergency contraception, or maybe even contraception, should be treated like condoms, for instance?
Yeah, you know, the American Congress of Obstetrics and Gynecology just recently released a very powerful statement recommending that birth control pills be over the counter. And this is based on really years of research that demonstrates that birth control pills are safe. So I'll say that again, birth control pills are safe, and contraception is good, and we should be improving access to contraception so that women can prevent unplanned pregnancies. In the U.S., 50% of all pregnancies are unintended.
Wow.
That is a staggering statistic, and it is so much worse than our sister countries where, you know, the proportion of unplanned pregnancies in the U.S. is 2 to 10 times higher than it is in other industrialized countries. And again, it's not because our sexual activity is different. It's because our contraceptive use is different.
Well, I'm also wondering, Anne Tuttleman, whether it makes sense, or maybe this is already happening, which is to teach teenagers to be sexually intimate, but that doesn't result in pregnancy. I mean, there are other ways to be sexually intimate besides having intercourse.
Right. And also, I think abstinence is a good option. We need teens to know that if they don't want to have sex, if they're not ready to have sex, if it's not time in this relationship, that abstinence is a perfectly good option for them. But in addition, there are other ways to be affectionate and that don't involve intercourse. And And this goes for all, you know, both heterosexual and homosexual youth. And so I think those are definitely things we should be teaching them. And there's also the female condom as well as the male condom. And we need to give them all these options, tools.
Katie, thanks for the call. Let's see what Kelly from Langhorne has to say. Kelly, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. My question is regarding helping teenagers to stay on the most effective forms of birth control. I was talking to a nurse practitioner at Planned Parenthood about they call them LARPs, and how important they are in teens. And she said up front, she said, you know, I know that in my head, but in my mind, I think I'm kind of stopping short of really pushing it because I'm so afraid that they're going to ask for them to be taken out after, you know, a few weeks or a month or so, because the bleeding profile on those products is different than on the short term, you know, the pills and such. I was wondering if your guests had any comments.
I bet they do. Let me toss that to you, Courtney Schreiber.
You raise such an important issue, and I think that's sort of the difference between what some of our own biases are as healthcare providers and what we really see in the data, because we have more and more great data coming out about long-term use or utilization overall among young people regarding these long-acting reversible methods that show that actually they're continued at much higher rates than other methods of contraception. Keep in mind that the average length of use of the birth control pill in this country is 4.5 months. So all we have to do is a little better than that, and we'll do better with child spacing and postponing pregnancy.
Because people don't want to take it, or they forget to take it?
There's so many different reasons for why people stop taking birth control pills: concern about side effects, access to prescription renewal, forgetting to take the pill and then not restarting again. But the point is, if we can remove all of that human behavior, all of those issues from contraception, that is exactly why the long-acting reversible methods are more effective. They work no matter what your environment may be and what the challenges could be. So as it turns out, while we do sort of pay special attention to those cases of women coming in asking for removal of their devices because we feel like it's our own personal failure, or we're so disappointed that they aren't continuing them for the full length of their possible use, even if they use them for a year or 2 years, that's outstanding contraception for that young woman who wouldn't have had such an effective method on board for that amount of time. And we've done some research with postpartum teens, so teens who've recently delivered a baby, and demonstrated that the use of the contraceptive implant has outstanding continuation rates out 1, 2, and 3 years, even though actually the practitioners in our institution were concerned that they were being removed at high rates. The data actually show that we have 75 to 80% continuation at 3 years postpartum for teens.
Kelly, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Courtney Schreiber, Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the Program Director for the Fellowship in Family Planning at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, Ann Teitelman, Associate Professor of Nursing and the Patricia Blesnack Silverstein and Howard A. Silverstein Chair in Global Women's Health at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. We're talking about adolescence and sexual health, contraception, sexual behavior. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
On the next Fresh Air, the U.S. Army's secret chemical weapons testing program. During the Cold War, LSD, nerve agents, and other drugs were tested on 5,000 healthy U.S. soldiers. We talk with Rafi Khachaturian about his article, Operation Delirium, published in this week's edition of The New Yorker. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Health exchanges are a key component of reform, and states have until the end of this week to decide if they're going to organize their own. Also, how the chance meeting of an elderly Holocaust survivor and a young mother sparked a 15-year relationship and a Hanukkah miracle of sorts. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We've been talking about a number of things, including the decline in the rate of teenage pregnancy in the last decade or so. Also, the fact that the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that adolescents have easier access to emergency contraception. And it was also mentioned that the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology said recently that birth control pills should be sold over the counter just like condoms. And again, talking with our guests today on Radio Times, Courtney Schreiber and Ann Teitelman. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And I know you want to talk about policy, and I guess we've been talking about all these various pieces. And policy, of course, should link all these pieces together.
Well, I think one thing of the Affordable Care Act has been to make to increase access to all services, and particularly access to contraceptives for women. And so now there should be coverage for women to get contraceptives paid for, including teenagers. And in addition, what we've had for many years is the Title X family planning monies that have provided clinical services for low-income women to get reproductive health care, low-income women and teens. And that has been a really, really successful policy that has had a huge impact on reducing the rates of unintended pregnancies and treating sexually transmitted infections and reducing those and testing for HIV across the United States. And so that type of policy we need to continue and see more of. And teens can access emergency contraception in any Title X clinic.
Well, and just to underscore what you said, that there, when you're looking at unintended pregnancies, there seems to be some connection to poverty. Is that true?
Yes.
That it tends to be poorer women who would end up with an unintended pregnancy.
Right. So in low-resource communities, we see more unintended pregnancies. We see more sexually transmitted infections. And we also see more partner violence. And so there's this dangerous mix for teens growing up in these environments where it's really hard to navigate with these higher rates of sexually transmitted infections in the community, in the social network, and then facing more violence, more coercion. And so when we don't have good access, that disproportionately affects low-income populations.
And it seems that that's a call for counseling. I mean, that these young girls, we're talking about larger teenage girls, that they need someone to talk to,
right,
to help navigate their complicated lives.
Right. And a lot of the girls I've talked to said they were facing very complex and difficult situations early on, 14, 13, you know, 15, and they didn't have anyone to talk to. They didn't have a safe place to process what was going on, and they did the best they could, and they ended up with a sexually transmitted infection and pregnant by the time they were 16 or 17. Mm-hmm. And that really thwarts girls' choices in terms of their education and being their whole life. And it's amazing how hard they work to overcome these early difficulties and how they end up often succeeding beyond great odds. But still, why do we make it so hard for these girls?
You want to add to that, and then we'll get back to our callers, Courtney?
Simply that, again, you know, these issues are reflective of a very complicated society that we live in. But we can make a very straightforward difference if we improve contraceptive use and sort of focus on the most effective methods of contraception for these teens. Because 50% of teens who have a baby when they are teenagers will get a high school diploma by the time they're 22. Mm. But 90% of their sisters who don't have a baby will get that high school diploma. So if we can just delay childbearing, that's part of this of our options for breaking the cycle of poverty for young women.
Let me get some more callers in. We have Chris from South Jersey joining us on Radio Times. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I have a question. I have three boys, 15, 10, and 4. And I just want to know what the experts on your panel thought about the gender differences in their research with educating them on sexual health. The way I see it is my 15-year-old, he's kind of in the game, so to speak. I can, you know, coach from the sidelines. My 10-year-old is not quite in the game, have a little more influence on him. Just kind of want to know if there's a, what your research kind of yielded with the differences in gender.
Sure.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
Chris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Anne, can I start with you?
Sure. I have two boys myself, a little older than that. But I think it's really important that we are having these conversations with boys as well as girls. So I really appreciate the caller's question. So I think, again, I don't think it's really all that different. We start early. We let them know what our values are and our views. We really promote healthy relationships, respectful relationships where people communicate, where each person in the relationship can make sure that their needs are known and that they feel in control of the decisions that are happening. Those are really bedrock basic things that need to happen as kids grow up and understand how it is to interact. And if those relationships are occurring in the family and you're promoting those among their peers, that was a great lesson for transferring over into their partnerships as they develop. Usually around 15 is when teens start dating. We do see it earlier in some areas in middle school, but it tends to be in early high school when dating begins. And well, dating begins earlier, but we actually see unhealthy type patterns evolving around age 15. And so we need to nip that in the bud before that age.
You're an OBGYN. Thoughts about boys?
Yeah. I don't take care of too many boys. However, I am aware of the importance of bringing boys back into the discussion on healthy sexuality and prevention of unplanned pregnancy. And I think one of the almost unintended consequences, unfortunate byproducts of our focus over the last 60 or so years of empowering women to control their own fertility, which is critical and key, has been is bringing our attention away from the component that and the participation of boys in that decision making, and has sort of disempowered boys as an active voice in healthy sexuality and planning parenting. Emergency contraception is one way, getting back to that topic, that boys can be involved because they can be the ones who go and purchase emergency contraception. And if it were to be fully over the counter, then that would be even easier for boys to be involved.
And chances are, in fact, we were thinking of adding another component to today's show, but we will certainly do something about boys and boy sexuality in a future show. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Chris, let's see what Dr. King from Philadelphia has to say. And you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My name is Bill King. I'm a pediatrician here in West Philadelphia.
Yes.
And just wanted to, express my, encouragement and, this policy trying to help docs and nurses give better advice for kids. But I think I just wanted to encourage the families who see me that almost none of us in general practice would hand out prescriptions for something like emergency contraception without really looking at that individual child, that, that daughter, that mother, that family, and the way that that particular piece of advice would impact all the decisions they may be making. And that would only be one piece of an extended discussion about making good choices. Boys make bad choices, girls make bad choices, and if you don't have contraception, you get pregnant. But the idea that we would all, because the AAP has rolled out a policy, those things evolve over time in terms of how that comes into a discussion.
Well, I appreciate the call because I think that's a good point, and I know both of our guests want to respond to that. Can you take that first, Courtney?
It's a very important point. I mean, this is all one part of a larger puzzle, and sort of the tenet of taking care of adolescents is to assess where that adolescent is, but also to try to address potential risk preemptively, because we know that only 40%, we know that only 60% of teens who have intercourse state that they used a condom at last intercourse. So they're not always prepared, so we have to be there ready to help them in the what-if type of situation, but also within the context of where that individual is developmentally.
You want to add to that, Ed?
Yeah, and I think we need to be talking to the girls as well as the boys. Girls often have older partners, so we need to be thinking about how those older male partners are making decisions with younger female teens. And the policy recommendation by the American Academy of Pediatrics suggests we're giving these emergency contraception prescriptions to boys as well as girls. I think, I really agree with Dr. King's comment that we need to counsel teens and families in the context of their lives and what's appropriate developmentally for them as well. So I appreciate that call.
When you talk about the age difference, are we talking about, you know, a 27-year-old man with a 15-year-old girl? Or, I mean, obviously it's going to vary, but when right. you talk about that, is that the difference we're talking about?
Well, it can be, but it can be even a couple of years. There's some indication from some studies that say that adolescent girls often have partners who are even 2 or more years older, and in those situations, there's a condom use is already decreased with that little bit of an age difference. So you can imagine as the age difference increases, the risks are likely to go up with that as well. Yeah.
Let me see what Linda from Forsham has to say. And Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. And that would be Linda, number 5. Do we have her? No, we don't have her. Let's try Tony from Mount Airy. And Tony, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, I was listening to the statements about the correlation in the industrialized countries with the use of birth control, and I was wondering if there's a correlation in the deplorable rate of mortality for our children as compared to other industrialized mm-hmm. countries in the use of this birth control.
The
non-use, I guess I should say.
Are you talking? You're talking about mortality rate and
yeah, for our children. I mean, our rates are so much worse than other industrialized countries in terms of health care and you know the rates of children dying. And I wondered
mortality.
If that was a relationship that could be made with their non-use of birth control.
Well, Tony, let me see what Courtney Schreiber says.
There are some links that demonstrate that unintended pregnancy is actually a risk factor for a lot of negative outcomes, health-wise, socioeconomically, and socially, for women and their children. So children who are born from an unintended pregnancy are at higher risk of death in the first year of life than children born from planned pregnancies, higher risk of hospitalization, and other negative outcomes. Mm. So at least in that very early stage of infancy, there certainly could be a link there.
Do you see a link?
Absolutely. I Corey said it all, I think. So,
let me ask you about pharmacies and doing some research in preparation for the show. Are pharmacies up on the laws and regulations? Do they stock, for instance, we've been talking about emergency contraception, and I'm looking at you, Anne. Do they stock these pills? Do they advise, you know, young people that might be coming in asking for these medications?
I think it's variable, but it's very likely that someone may go in and ask for emergency contraception, and maybe they had 5 bottles and they're all gone today, and they'd have to come back another day for another one. Mm-hmm. So I think the supplies are variable, and the information that's given out is variable. Pharmacists are often very good at asking if someone needs a little bit of extra information, but I think that's also mm-hmm. quite variable. And we're also seeing some pharmacies using nurse practitioners in the pharmacy, and that would be a great way to get additional information as well. But the idea is that not to restrict it to just clinics, you know, to pharmacies where there is a nurse practitioner, but it would be great if all pharmacists could be knowledgeable on emergency contraception and stock enough so that anyone who wants it could get it.
But is there a concern, Courtney, that emergency contraception becomes someone's everyday contraception? And by that I mean instead of using a condom or using some of the other birth controls, that they end up using emergency contraception instead?
Doesn't appear to be a concern. From the data that we have on users of emergency contraception, women will occasionally use emergency contraception up to 2 times in 1 cycle, but women are not using it long-term multiple times over the course of months. First of all, emergency contraception is expensive, so that's not a very cost-effective way to contracept. It can be $50.
Oh, wow.
And it's a hassle to get, as we just described, and up to 35 to 48% of pharmacists do not dispense emergency contraception. So I think that variability that Anne is talking about we need to take that variability out of the equation. It shouldn't be up to a pharmacist whether or not a woman has access to an FDA-approved drug. A woman should be able to make that choice with her doctor or, frankly, even without her doctor. I think the data that was recently presented to the FDA, which, by the way, the FDA did recommend that Plan B, one step B, truly over-the-counter. None of this behind-the-counter stuff, no dual approval for whether, depending on the age of the person who's trying to obtain EC, that Plan B should be over-the-counter because it is safe, and that was what the FDA recommended based on the fact that even young teens are able to decide whether or not it is the right medication for them.
But the Obama administration, Kathleen Sebelius, Health and Human Services, put a stop to that.
Yes, this is the one-year anniversary.
Oh, it is mm-hmm. today?
Well, right around now.
Mm-hmm. So do you think this recommendation from the American Academy of Pediatrics will be more than just a recommendation? Do you think it'll be implemented?
Well, I mean, their recommendation, there were several aspects of the recommendation, but I do think that it gives it encourages pediatricians to be proactive about discussing mm-hmm. these topics and offering advanced supply of emergency contraception, and hopefully eventually it will be over the counter.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for coming in and joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you very much. A very important discussion. Courtney Schreiber, an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology and the program director for the Fellowship in Family Planning at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity, Marty.
You're welcome. And Ann Teitelman is associate professor of nursing and Patricia Blesnack Silverstein and Howard A. Silverstein Chair in Global Women's Health at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. Thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Emily Bryant helping us out today. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us. And coming up next, it's Here and Now. We do rebroadcast Radio Times.